My firm belief is if you're not using AI, you will be losing work to people who do. It's a slow-moving train that you need to hop on now. Learn about the tools, learn about what updates are coming out. You need to start implementing it into your workflow because you literally will lose work.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Documentary First. I'm your host, Christian Taylor. That, my friends, is Armin Corsus. He's a working filmmaker telling you what he sees coming. Armin is a filmmaker who truly belongs to the world. He was born in the Cayman Islands to Hungarian parents, and now he's a fixture of the Chicago film scene. His outsider looking in perspective shapes everything he makes and everything he does. Today, we're going to talk to him about how he uses commercial work to fund the creative projects he wants to make. We're also going to talk to him about why he thinks every working filmmaker ought to be using AI right now, and about the Chicago film community he co-founded that's grown from 50 people to 1,700 in 1 year. Armin is a wealth of wisdom for filmmakers at any stage. So come on, let's get into it and see what he has to say. So Armin, it's so great to have you here. Thank you for making time for us.
Thank you so much for having me and for the amazing intro. You're way too kind. And also congratulations on now doubling your output with the podcast. Very impressive.
Yeah, thank you.
I think what you do with this podcast is so amazing because I think filmmaking in general can be quite a lonely journey. So I think even if it's like an online feeling of community, I think it's amazing to be able to have, you know, a platform like yours to tune into, listen to new advice and hear from different people from all over the country about what they're working on and advice they might have. So it's truly amazing.
I think we have that same passion. I've been trying to do it in this online world. You've been doing it in the real world. I hope we can combine our forces because I think there's some beauty in that because I think we need both. The online world can reach far and wide, but I think we're desperate for that absolute in-person connection. And we're going to get to that later on in the podcast because I'm really excited about what you're doing. But I really want to get to know you more personally, I want our audience to, because I feel like the work you're doing is born out of who you are as a man. And that started from where you were born and who your parents were and what your upbringing is. And it's very unique. So take me all the way back to when you were born and where, who your parents were. Just tell me the story of you.
Yeah. So I had a very unique upbringing. And I like to say that no matter which direction I'm flying, I'm always going home. I was mostly grew up in the United States, but I was randomly born in the Cayman Islands. I was not a vacation baby. My parents actually lived there for a decade. And my parents both were from the same hometown of Kalocsa in Hungary, grew up there, and then they got married there. And my mom works with children with cerebral palsy. And she got a job in the Cayman Islands, which at the time, coming from Hungary, they literally didn't even know where it was on the map. I mean, especially in Europe, people don't really know the Cayman Islands, especially in Hungary. And they moved there and ended up staying for 10 years. My brother and I were born there. We moved back to Hungary. And then in 2005, we moved to the U.S. into the Chicago suburbs. And then I went to middle school here, high school here, and college in Chicago. I moved here. I didn't speak any English. I was 7 years old and then very quickly learned English. And then actually it was one of my strongest subjects in school, in high school, and then later in college. And I think my love for storytelling really was inspired by my father. He is an oil painter. He's an artist. And I always grew up around him painting and, of course, taking reference photographs for his paintings that he wanted to paint. And so I was always around cameras in some capacity. And we did a lot of very low budget, very long trips. Like in high school, actually it was in middle school, we did an 80 day long, 12,000 mile road trip through the US. If you draw basically a triangle from Chicago all the way up to Vancouver, down to the Mexican border and back was basically the route that we took over 80 days. It was the very first day of summer break until the very last day of summer break, and then we went right back to school.
Wow.
We tent camped for 80 days. Didn't stay in a hotel once. Had beautiful weather, went to all the national parks, and I really enjoyed documenting those trips and taking photographs, and then later I would start doing videos. And then in high school, I started making these recap videos for these trips, and I really loved capturing them. And even on our other trips, I would write like blogs, you know, you could do like a WordPress blog for free and like the hosting was free. And I would just like to type away and really write about our trips and document the stories. And I realized, like, originally I wanted to be a marine biologist. I was never good at biology or science and stuff like that, but I loved animals. I loved the ocean. And I was trying to think what I wanted to do. And I think by like junior year of high school, I figured out, like, I want to be a filmmaker. I want to go to film school, and Columbia College was a great option for me. And I wanted to stay local to Chicago. So that's basically up to speed on where I went to school and how we wound up in the U.S.
That is the fast version, but what an exciting childhood. Your parents just seem so brilliant and just curious people, which I think curious people make phenomenal storytellers. I would love to meet your parents. But, you know, I want to go back. You said your parents didn't have any idea where the Cayman Islands were. So can you put them on the map for us? Because your film talks a lot about the Cayman Islands. Where are they?
So they're about 100 miles south of Cuba, and it's actually British overseas territory. So it's similar relationship to like Puerto Rico's relationship to the U.S. The difference is the Cayman Islands has its own government, but it's under like crown rule. Like the governing is still a little bit closer associated to the to England than Puerto Rico is to the U.S., but kind of similar relationship. They do drive on the other side, a very small island. It's a group of three islands. People typically vacation in Grand Cayman, which is now about 100,000 people. And then my film that I shot takes place on Cayman Brac, which is about 2,000 people. And then there's Little Cayman, which is one of like the top three diving spots on the planet. And there's about, I think, less than 200 people live there full time. So very small island, no facilities, no nothing. If you want to be off the map and not be close to anybody, then that's where you're going to move.
Now, do you remember well growing up there? Because it sounds like you were only 7 when you left.
I actually moved away from the Cayman Islands when I was 2. And then we moved back to Hungary for a few years. So I don't remember anything at all. Luckily, my parents still stay in touch with a lot of family friends who had kids about our age. And then now we're, you know, rekindling our friendships and staying in touch with everybody. So a lot of family friends in the Cayman Islands still.
Then how did growing up in Hungary shape you?
It was a beautiful upbringing. My parents built a house there. And I think it was a really tough decision to leave Hungary, but already over 20 years ago, it was already a tough economic situation. And my parents really wanted the best upbringing for us. I think one of the key things was they wanted us to speak English without an accent. And they're able to gift that to my brother and I. I think it's one of the most important things that we were ever given. The way I like to describe Hungary is it's a beautiful country, but the ceiling is significantly lower than the U.S. Like if you think in terms of entertainment, advertising, like the U.S. is really the center, one of the centers of the world that people really look up to, especially in film. And the ceiling in Hungary is significantly lower. It's a country of 10 million people. So even if you're the very, very best at something, I mean, there's a low ceiling that you're going to hit pretty quickly. And not many people speak Hungarian globally. It's completely a unique language. It's not a romance language. It's completely unique. It's not related to Italian, French, anything. It's a unique language. So my parents are adamant about us learning English and wanted to give us the best opportunity by moving to the U.S.
Tell me about the values you grew up with, because I sense that you care about people and you care about the planet and you care about animals and you care about quality of life and real connection with people. That's deep-seated, genuine authenticity. Talk to me about the values your parents raised you with. Where did that come from?
I think my parents just raised us to be very caring people. Like, I think the whole, like, you treat others how you want to be treated. I think being a good person, doing good work and treating people well, I think is just in general great life advice. And I was really lucky that my parents from the very beginning were extremely supportive of me pursuing art. I don't take it for granted because I know a lot of people with their parents, especially when they're younger, it is an uphill battle to really convince them, like, hey, instead of taking a steady, secure career, I'm going to pursue the arts, which is the very opposite sometimes. And I didn't take it for granted. My dad gave me one advice when picking my concentration in college. He said, don't go to school to be a photographer. And it's going to be really hard and you need to work your ass off, but you can do it. I think that realistic advice is really important because if you're, you know, giving people like these grandiose, you know, this image of like what film can be and like it's going to be easy, I would say that's completely wrong. I think film is extremely hard, But the saying that if you like what you do, you're never going to work a day in your life.
Yeah, yeah. 100%. And it seems to me, please correct me if I'm wrong, but your parents themselves were not after money as their goal. Your mother seemed to genuinely care about helping people. Your father did care about the arts and beautiful things and sharing those beautiful things with the world. So their value system did seem to be rooted in something different than making money. But at the same time, they also valued experiences, clearly. If they're giving you an 80-day trip across the world and showing you how to embrace that kind of life, but with a very simple way of living. Is that right?
100%. And I think my parents really did their very best to show us as much of the world as possible. Of course, growing up, we would go back to Hungary every summer to see, we still have grandparents living there and uncles and cousins. And then we wanted to see as much of the U.S. as possible. I definitely don't take it for granted. I mean, I think by the time I was 18, I've got to say I had been to about 30 countries already and traveled all over Europe and traveled all over the United States. And I think, you know, Europe is beautiful and the United States is beautiful. And I don't take it for granted. I think a lot of people don't get that experience. And I think travel has really shaped my perspective on the world. I think it's made me much more open-minded. I think being a good traveler also makes you a better documentary filmmaker. You don't let your fear of travel limit what is possible, because a lot of people are very overwhelmed with traveling, right? Like renting a car in a foreign country, driving on the other side of the road, the steering wheel is on the other side. Things like that. I mean, it's intimidating. And luckily that muscle was really built up for us from a very young age. And my brother and I are very experienced travelers, of course. So, you know, navigating a foreign airport and checking luggage and all that is not really something that I get too much anxiety over these days.
That's a beautiful gift that your parents gave you. I agree with you 100%. Being able to travel like that is an ultimate gift. And the thing that it gives back to you is that it does help you to understand different cultures, different people, and it gives you a less ethnocentric, way of looking at the world. And I think as filmmakers, we do have a responsibility then to share that with the rest of the world who don't have the ability to travel like that. Now let's look at film school, because you decided to choose Columbia College, and there is this big debate, is film school worth it? You have a camp that says it was helpful. It's helpful for connections. It is helpful for the things you learn. There's another camp that says it's a lot of money, particularly right now. Do I want to incur those costs, particularly now when I'm not sure there's a return? Now with the tidal wave and the earthquake and the, you know, tsunami that's happening in the entertainment industry, is film school worth it?
Short answer is, for me, it was worth it, but it comes down to money. How much money are your parents willing to give you for school? Are you sitting on $250,000 college fund that you would like to invest into school? If you have that, that's an amazing gift. I definitely did not have that. I would say it was worth it because I worked my butt off getting scholarships. I got a massive $8,000 portfolio scholarship when I was like 17, you know, going into applying to Columbia College. And at the time I'm like, wow, this project is worth $8,000. Like, I thought that was crazy, you know? And got college credits from high school as well. So I was able to graduate half a year early and take more courses that I was genuinely interested in rather than like the gen ed courses that, you know, they make you take. And I had a couple really influential professors at Columbia that I definitely like would be a different person today if I had not taken those courses, particularly courses that I think should be mandatory for everybody, like marketing and branding yourself. And in these courses, I learned how to make a website, business cards, networking basics, which are all fundamentals, I think, for anybody in any industry, not just documentary filmmaking. And I did take a lot of documentary courses at Columbia at the time that really had a big impact on me. And I think even just working the muscle of getting feedback on your projects, how to deal with, you know, you just finished your beautiful project and someone saying, hey, redo this scene, remove this, add this. How do you deal with that? How do you receive feedback without having your ego bruised with a project that you've been working on for 2 or 3 years? And now people are saying it's not the best projects they've ever seen. All of those, I think, really shaped who I am today. And I don't have any regrets with going to school, I guess, is my bottom line. But it's a completely unique question to every single person. And I think ultimately the best thing you could do if you're a student listening to this podcast is speak to as many people as possible, do, you know, informal informational interviews, ask for people's advice, and then you have to boil down the advice to what pertains to you and then make the decision yourself.
100% wise advice right there, because it is so unique to every individual based on their financial situation, their outcomes, their learning style, what they want to do afterwards. Just so many different things play into that decision. And I think about group projects. Group projects in college is a pain in the butt, but it is also a wonderful petri dish for figuring out, can you work with a team? Another wonderful example of that is you get to, in film school, do several different roles and decide, do I really want to do this? You may go in there thinking, I want to be a director, but you may realize that I'm better at editing, or vice versa. There are a lot of pluses and minuses, not to mention the networking, particularly if you're in a city like Chicago or New York or LA. But Chicago, I think, is particularly wonderful for this situation because it gives you the option to start here in a wonderful, safe environment where there's so many opportunities, and then branch off to the coast, depending on what you're interested in. So I think that's just such a wonderful answer. Very wise. You then went from film school and decided, by founding your film company, you needed to do two things. You wanted to be able to pursue passion projects that you were really interested in, such as documentary filmmaking, but you realized you had to make a living too. Is that how your company was born? Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah. And I think even taking a step back into how I even decided to start a company was my background and coming from a team sports background. I was a swimmer and water polo player in high school. And I think that I love building a team. It's the same as sports. And I can very quickly also, when I'm working with new people, I can pick up on if you played team sports growing up or not, just because of like fundamentally how you work with people, who you like, you don't like, your communication styles. Even working with, like when I'm directing, I'm working with cinematographers. Do you like to work with someone who you hold their hand the entire way? Or do you want to be completely hands off and just give vague, you know, direction and then let someone take the reins, right? Like you really, and there's no right or wrong answer. Like everybody works differently and everyone's working relationship is different. But I think you have to understand who you are, right? I get overwhelmed if I have to handhold every single person. It's like the funny saying, like working with you is like working alone, but harder. Like if I have to handhold you through a production, then I'd rather just shoot it myself. I also like to shoot. I like to film and camera operate. So when I look for collaborators, I like to draw the sandbox, tell them how this is going to work, and then let them do what they're best at, because I have a good understanding of pretty much every aspect of production, but I want to hire people who are better than me and work with people who are better than me. I don't think you want to see how I would do someone's makeup on a film shoot, but I can hire the right personality. And I think even just deciding how to assemble a team for a certain project is really important. And in school, I really loved the aspect of chasing my own work, being my own boss, and being in charge of putting teams together. I knew that going the union direction that film school was pointing me in, like union television and episodic television series and all of that, like they didn't really talk about the commercial world. And of course, they spoke about documentaries because I was in the documentary, you know, side of the film industry and the film department at Columbia. But they didn't talk about commercial. And then I would work on commercial sets and PA and learn more and more about it. And I'm like, the day rates are really high. The shoots are 1 to 3 days long. They're creatively challenging in their own ways. And then I can make good money and then put it into a project that I genuinely want to shoot. And I thought, there's really not many downsides to this besides, you know, chasing the dream of I want to shoot a feature film. But little known secret, a lot of the people who also shoot features also shoot commercial work, right? And they fill in the gaps of their income throughout the year when they're not doing episodic union, you know, television work or feature films. So that's how it came out, was born. I've been running my company now for 5 years. And we specialize specifically in commercial work, documentary films, and then the intersection of the two, branded content and branded long form storytelling.
And how has that been going for you? I, too, have been running my own company. I think I'm going on now 15 years. And it does take a while. A, it takes money to make money. That's a truism. B, it takes at least 5 years to become profitable. You do have to market yourself continually. It isn't easy, particularly to be in your left brain running a company and then in your right brain trying to be a creative person doing creative endeavors. How are you finding this going for you?
I think you have to figure out what you're good at, put your energy into that. And if you don't like to do something, then hire out or find different people who are better at that skill. So I love talking to people. I love networking. I think when I get on a call, I can pretty much, like, I can sell a project. I can book a project. The outreach is very time consuming. And that was something I think when I first started out, I underestimated how much consistent outreach you have to do to make sure that your acquisition keeps coming in, right? Like, you need to keep clients.
You have to have a rainmaker. There is no question about that.
Yes. Yeah. Like, you, even when you don't feel like it, you have to do it. But it's been an amazing journey. I would never trade it for anything. And I think being able to control like what projects I take and working with so many different talented people, it's been an amazing journey. It was really funny that I graduated college during COVID, and then I started my company basically on the back end of COVID. And then now we're dealing with the AI wave. So it's like one after the other. But I think you just have to ride it out and really be flexible and adaptable. And I don't think the complaining will get you anywhere. I think you know, keeping on top of everything and really understanding the new tools that are at your disposal and taking advantage of them and using it to your advantage as much as possible.
Great advice. Talk to me about the project that you are most excited about. What are you most proud of in your commercial work?
We shot a motorcycle commercial for a motorcycle rental company out in Colorado, and they gave us very little money but full creative control. So I said, hey, it's basically a paid passion project that we can shoot over 3 days, and you're able to shoot on Independence Pass, which is between Twin Lakes and Aspen. One of the most beautiful roads in the whole country. It's like closed most of the year because of the snow and how high the altitude is. But that was just such a beautiful project because filming in places where the scenery is beautiful, every direction you point a camera, I don't take it for granted. That was just such a fun project. The client absolutely loved the project, and it still is one of the main capstone portfolio pieces that we have on our site.
Talk to me about what the hardest one was. What was the most challenging one you've shot?
We were working with a tech company that was launching. It's still on our site, I believe. It's a company called Protégé. It's basically industry professionals in the music industry could evaluate digital auditions. It's basically like America's Got Talent or The Voice, but it's like for a digital platform. And they came to us, and we had to turn the project around from like concept to finishing it, I think, within 5 days because they were launching and they needed a video for their homepage. And I mean, we were able to pull it off. Like, I think in those moments, you need to find, again, the right crew, right personalities, get everybody up on the same page, make sure you're not like weighed down by too much stuff, and really get a good storyboard and stick to your, you know, plan and really shoot it. And because we had such a good plan going into it, the edit came together really easily, and then we were able to launch it on time. So I'm really proud when the team works together on meeting deadlines like that. Some projects take 6 weeks to finish or 3 weeks or whatever. I mean, 5 days is pretty insane. And that was before AI too. That was like before the whole AI wave. So everything was still completely manual.
Speaking of AI, how that's changed for you and how you've integrated it into your work.
So it's a great question. I know people are probably super tired of talking about AI and AI this, AI that. My firm belief in AI is if you're not using AI, you will be losing work to people who do. I think it's just a fact of life. I think it's a slow moving train that you need to hop on now. Learn about the tools, learn about what updates are coming out. You need to start implementing into your workflow because you literally will lose work. I've seen it firsthand. If you can increase your output, your outreach, network better, email better, and stay on top of your communication, all of that are the fundamentals and the foundation of a business, then you're simply going to increase the amount of luck that comes your way, right? Like, the harder you work, the more you put yourself out there, the more likely you are to succeed. The way I'm using AI is really minimizing the amount of time I spend doing the repetitive, annoying tasks such as all the documentation that goes with a shoot, okay? Independent contractor agreements, location releases, non-disclosures, general non-disclosure, talent releases, call sheets, invoicing, all of that is just PDFs and paperwork. All of this we're working on automating all of this on the back end, because if you can take your pre-production time from, let's say, 20 hours of manually emailing all these documents back and forth, you forget to attach something, this producer didn't get that document, so on and so forth. If all of this is in a central place and it's nice and organized, if you could take your pre-production, all the document stuff from 20 hours down to 30 minutes, I mean, I'm spending then more time storyboarding, doing all the creative work that actually needs my 100% human, genuine attention to detail and my human connection. If you can streamline everything and minimize the amount of things that you need to, you know, the bottleneck is your memory, right? Your ability to remember what you need to, who you need to email, who's still missing stuff. If you have a central place where you can track invoices, track who signed which contract, making sure the call sheets are very clear, everyone is actually getting them, and making sure that your communication is completely streamlined and solid and automated, I think the better, because you need to be involved with the creative stuff. And if your time is being taken away from the stuff where you actually need your full 100% attention, then I think the projects suffer. If we're able to minimize the amount of time in general that a project takes to complete, and you can increase the clear communication between pre-production, the production team, and then on to post-production, whether it's a commercial or a documentary film project, then you can take on more work, you can make more money and be more profitable. So that's how I'm using AI. I also think, like, if you can create, everyone's talking about image generation and video generation with AI. I think if you use that as a tool to communicate your concepts better and communicate it to your production team, like, hey, we're going for this shot. Here's like a pre-viz essentially of the shoot that we're doing. I think it's great. I use image generation for pitch decks all the time. We did this for the Cayman Brac film, which we'll talk about soon. I generated a bunch of images of the island that looked completely believable and had to put them in a pitch deck that I needed to put together quicker. If I'm able to send 40 pitches to 40 different companies rather than like 8, then you're increasing the likeliness of getting funded and getting out there and really staying in touch with the right people. So I see no disadvantages to it. Yeah. How are you using AI?
I have believed from the beginning that if you don't learn how to ride the wave, the undertow will take you under. You have to adapt or die. So I've been trying to figure that out, which one is the most useful. I've lately determined that for me, Claude, the latest, highest version, has been the most useful. So I've chosen to pay $100 a month right now. The way that I have been using it is a lot of research. I wanted to understand, how can I make things better for my company? How can I improve the podcast and my reach? What do I need to change? It's helping me do things that would take me hours and hours and hours to go through all that stuff manually. The one thing that I continuously have to do is check everything all the time. It doesn't matter what AI it is, and I'm constantly having to rewrite a ton of stuff. The important thing to do in the very beginning is to set it up how you want it to talk to you. The instructions when you set up your AI in the beginning are crucial. And then using the project folders for each project you manage and the specific instructions for that project, understanding how to use the tools you have and knowing how to ask the questions or the commands that you give it are also really important. So you can't just use AI, but you have to use it intelligently and to understand what the problems with it are and be constantly reading up on what's changing. It's a lot to keep up with.
Yeah, I mean, right now I'm spending I'm setting aside 15 to 20 minutes every single night to watch a new tutorial on new features coming out. I also use Claude, but I think like keeping up with all the updates is super important. And I think you hit on a really key thing, Christian, is your input still matters, right? Because you can't just tell AI like, hey, write me a 100-page feature film script about a boy, a girl, a dog in Florida. Okay. Like, it's not going to come up with good original ideas. It's similar to physical training, right? If you get a trainer, if you're not willing to put the work in, you're not going to see any results. You need to change your diet. You need to work hard. It's the same thing here. Actually, the CEO of NVIDIA said this recently, which I loved his quote. He said, the playing field is level. The differentiator between who's successful and who's not in the future is who has the best original ideas. Because now there's no gatekeeping of knowledge. I don't, unfortunately for the coders, I don't need to know how to code. I don't need to know how to custom make a website. I don't need to know how to make an app. If I have an idea and I have a problem that I need a solution for, I can literally make it tomorrow and the playing field is level. And it's the same thing here where I do the same thing. I was speaking at DePaul University to some students. I had a presentation And as I was reworking it, all of them were my ideas. I said, let's restructure so the flow makes sense. So we started with pre-existing beliefs maybe the students have, then like tools and takeaways, the truths of what I found, and then like a nice summary and had a really good flow instead of jumping around back and forth through the presentation where it's like, hey, it might be a little overwhelming to bounce all around. But it's recycling and kind of redoing what my original ideas were. It's the same thing with another practical example of this is we submitted BRAC to 19 different festivals. When a festival says, hey, can you give me a 150 character long summary of your film? Okay, well, if I had a 200 character summary, then how am I going to rewrite this but not lose the essence of what the film is? So I wrote out all the log lines, the summary, everything manually. And I said, hey, rewrite this for this length or this character count or whatever. And then you're not just agonizing over, hey, am I still capturing the essence of the summary of my film when I'm submitting to festivals? It completely does. And it rewrites it in my language. And it's you know, you can apply to more festivals quicker.
I had to pay a publicist to do that sort of stuff when I was doing The Girl Who Wore Freedom. And I was applying to 200 film festivals and all this other stuff. And it cost me so much money and time because everything had different parameters and word length. Another practical application is I filmed Heroes of Carentan in 2022 and 2023 and haven't been able to raise the finishing funds. Recently, I had to give an annual update to my fiscal sponsor, and I needed to give them a summary of where we were. And in the middle of that, I thought, you know, it's been a really long time since I've gone over all the information. And I thought, wait a minute, I have AI now. So I took all of the summaries, like all of the transcripts of all the interviews that we did, and I put them in Claude, and I asked them to summarize them for me. Then I realized after they did that successfully and summarized them, I was like, oh yeah, I remember all of this. Then I found all of this stuff that I had scanned in the 101st Airborne Division Museum. So much stuff that it would have taken me months to read it all. And I uploaded it into Claude and I asked it to summarize each thing. And then I said, show me the connections between all of these. This was a perfect case example for how it saved me hours. It was, I put in my outline for what I had already done and all I'd already written. All the work was mine, but I needed somehow to synthesize all of that and summarize all the stuff and have a back and forth with somebody. And that's how I used it. So that's the sort of stuff it's good for, but you have to know how to use the tool.
100%. I think especially for summaries, like I'm ideating all the time. I'll talk to it for 10 minutes. Hey, can you summarize what I said in bullet points? Like stuff like that. It's so, so helpful for. Same with like, I'm very active on LinkedIn, writing LinkedIn posts, boiling it down from certain things I've posted or written about. Let's break this into separate posts and stuff. So if you can increase your output and really have good input is the first thing that's the number one thing that's so important. Then I think the output will also be significantly better.
And one word of caution I tell people all the time, you must be the creative input. Otherwise, Claude has the creative IP. So you cannot have Claude or any other AI do the creative work for you. You must be the creator if you want the IP. So last word of advice on IP and
great advice.
Today's episode is brought to you by our friends over at Virgil Films. With over 25 years of distribution experience, Virgil has released such hits as Super Size Me and the Oscar-nominated Restrepo, along with a trove of indie treasures like Forks Over Knives, To Die For, 7 Yards, and Speed is Expensive. Now, you can find all of those films, along with the entire Virgil catalog, on any transactional platform out there like Amazon, Apple TV, YouTube, Tubi, and the rest. Are you a filmmaker and you're having trouble with distribution? Talk to Virgil. They work with every major platform directly, and they offer a variety of deals that fit with every filmmaker's needs, from standard distribution to service deals. They do it all. And they don't just distribute films. They elevate them. Truthfully, they're just really good people to work with. So if you want to learn more, head on over to virgilfilms.com. And tell them Christian Taylor sent you. And now, on with the show. Now, let's move on to BRAC. BRAC is a beautiful short film. I would love you to give the setup for it. Tell us all about the film, and then we'll dive in.
BRAC is a 15-minute short conservation documentary. a beautiful story about a small island showing a global issue on a small scale. And I was really specific about making the film to make sure that it is relevant to everybody that watches it. It has to answer the number one question with documentaries is, why should I care? Why does this matter to me? The film explores the intersection of land rights and land management, how humans have impacted the decline of the native brown booby bird on the island, and how rock climbers and the locals all intersect, and what the future of the island really is all about, and when should humans actually decide to step in and solve problems that we are responsible for causing in the first place. I think we packed as much story into this 50-minute film as we possibly could have, and super proud of how it came out. I could not have done it without my editor, Ethan Edmonds. This was our second collaboration. Last year with our 5-minute surfing film, we went to Mountain Film Festival with that, and we came back for another project to work on together. So came out beautifully, but way exceeded my expectations.
The music is lovely. The footage is absolutely beautiful. Makes me want to go there and visit. What I enjoyed about this film was oftentimes in films that make us aware of problems where nature is concerned, you walk away feeling like a very yucky human and that this is all on my shoulders. There's nothing I can do anyway. Now I just feel guilty. And, you know, there's just a lot of hopelessness. I didn't feel that way when I was watching your film. I felt inspired. I cared about the situation here. What I did love is that there were people involved and they loved what was happening there. You brought the problem to the forefront and you let people discuss it. At the end, you basically were saying the people that live here have to decide what they want. And that's true for all of us. We have to decide, what do we want our world to be like? And you kind of just say, it's up to us. Before we go any further, I'd like to show you a moment from Arden's film and introduce you to these really special rare birds.
They got a chick. Yeah. Oh, look at this little head. In the Cayman Islands, brown booby birds are unique to the Brag. The boobies do nest as a colony, and they will come back to the same areas. They'll usually lay a couple eggs, but usually only one of them will survive. They have easy access to deep waters offshore where they can catch flying fish. It's one of the reasons they would choose Cayman Brac, and historically have nested here.
Armin, talk to me about the challenges these birds are facing.
It's a really unique story. One of the big problems on the island outside of land rights and land use is the introduction of feral cats on the island, which were introduced by humans. These feral cats are eating 3 to 8 small animals and critters like birds and lizards and bird eggs a day. So if you have thousands of cats on an island, I mean, they're just decimating the local, you know, reptilian populations and bird populations. And it really was an interesting story to cover because everyone has, of course, a different perspective and opinion. And I think as a documentary filmmaker, especially as a director, you are tempted to force your opinion onto a story. But I think showcasing both sides, especially on a divisive issue like what this film is about, it's really important to give a fair platform to everybody involved and then really shape the story afterwards. But I was really keen on getting like the people who love the cats or want to protect the cat, that perspective, the locals, the rock climbers, and the government also, their government employees, specifically working with the Department of the Environment and kind of the work they're doing. And it all, I think, intersects in a really beautiful way.
Yeah, you gave everybody a fair voice. I really did find the gentleman who actually lives on the island fascinating. Why don't you talk a little bit about him? How did you meet him?
So, little backstory about the film. So, even though it was only 15 minutes, it took me 3 different trips to shoot this film. Each of the trips were like 2 to 5 days long. And by the 3rd trip, I knew I had to get a local perspective. Like, I think a quick little side note is, especially when a film is taking months or years to shoot, you have to be reviewing footage, you have to be listening to the interviews and really like transcribing everything and seeing what you have and what you don't, because if you finish your last trip, especially if it's in an inaccessible place where it's going to be practically impossible to go back and keep filming, whether it's for financial reasons or access reasons, it's going to be very hard to, you know, edit together your film if you're missing like a important part of the story. And the last one, I did it the old fashioned way. Like I knew I had to get an older person who's a native on the island. And the plane that we take over from Grand Cayman to Cayman Brac is like 20 people. Okay. It's like a really small prop plane. The flight is like 20 minutes. And I was making small talk on people with people on the plane. And I said, you know, I'm working on this project. I was born on Grand Cayman. That's really important to emphasize here is like there are people who have their guard down when you tell them that you're at least born, you know, in the Cayman Islands. And so I used that card and I said, I'm working on this project. I really am looking for different perspectives. And they said, go talk to Tennyson Scott. And multiple people said this to me. And I'm like, Tennyson Scott, like, I don't even know how to spell Tennyson. I've never even met anybody named Tennyson. They, and mind you, the island, like, they didn't give me an address. They didn't have street addresses or anything for, like, while my parents were still living there in the 90s, by the way. Like, it's literally, they would draw maps on the envelope and say, deliver the mail, like, past the big tree on the right, past the gas station.
And sounds like so Mississippi, where I grew up.
Yeah, I mean, same thing here. And I'm on the plane and they're like, Tennyson Scott is going to be a great person to interview. I don't have a phone number. I don't have an email. I don't have an address. I don't have anything about this man. And I'm like, okay, that was worth a shot. I'll just, you know, whatever, try my best. And I'm driving through Spot Bay on one of my last days on the island. And there's two older gentlemen sitting in front of a house. And that man turned out to be Tennyson Scott. And I just happened to have my camera gear in the trunk. I had everything ready to go, you know, tripod, lavalier microphone. And he luckily was a yapper. He loved to talk. Best case scenario for any documentary film interview, you know, you're not like, you know, having to squeeze every ounce of information out of somebody, you know, begging for some crumbs. This guy was like, I mean, I interviewed him for over 90 minutes. I mean, I had to end it at the end because the light was changing so much. The sun was setting. And we went over everything. I mean, it was great to just make him talk. I think with those, in those situations, like having a grasp of the story you're telling, the questions you need to have ready to go in your head or written down, whatever your format is, and just being ready to seize an opportunity. I mean, the fact that I was able to just find this guy sitting in front of his house that everyone was talking about is crazy. But yeah, I think it was one of the most important perspectives that we featured in the film, because this is a guy who's approaching the age of 90. That has seen the island go through massive changes since he grew up. And I think it really added this unique perspective to the film that otherwise would have been, you know, completely lost if I didn't get that interview. So
I agree with you. And what I loved about what he said was, we can't fish. We can't do this. What are you talking about? I've done this my whole life. It's a problem that I fish. You know, it's a problem that I catch this. It's a problem that I ate an egg. I mean, God gave us this to do these things. He's got a point. These things wouldn't be a problem if it was just the way it used to be, if it was just these people on the island, the way it was intended to be, just taking what we needed for ourselves. But life has changed those things since then.
Times have changed. Even when he was growing up, and in the film, I think under 30 nesting pairs of these brown booby birds, when he was growing up, it was tens of thousands of birds. So wow. At the time, you know, you pick up a couple eggs, and these are a little bit bigger than a chicken egg. These birds are, you know, full grown. They're about a 6 foot wingspan. They're like between 2 and 8 pounds weight wise. These are pretty big birds. And I mean, picking up a few eggs at the time wasn't a big deal. Now, when you only have like 15 to 25 fledglings per season and you end up picking up a few eggs, that's a big problem, especially when their survival rate is so low, even if they do end up hatching. Very interesting perspective. And the film features somebody with a true Brac accent. The Bracker accent is super unique. It was very hard to understand at first, but I think it's something that AI can't replace. You can't fake that. You can't find anybody online with that accent. So it's super important to do that. And fun fact for you, by the way, and the listeners, is the intro and the outro narration that's a really cool story too. That guy was also born on Cayman Brac. He is the former premier of the Cayman Islands. Premier is like the equivalent of like governor, basically, in the U.S. And I was flying back home at the very end of my third trip. Okay, so I didn't go back after this trip. And through some friends, I'm messaging people. I said, I really need someone to interview. And there's a guy who's a friend of a friend. My dad used to work in his bookstore back in the 90s. Okay. And he said, I can't do the narration. I have a Georgetown accent. I'm not a Bracker. Okay. And so there's differences even within Grand Cayman of the different dialects and accents. And so I said, okay, that's fine. He has a lovely golden voice, so it was a shame. But I said, oh, anybody I could do a narration with. And I had the script written and everything. I was ready to go. He said, interview this guy, James Ryan. I reach out to him. He meets me in the airport parking lot in between my connection. I put my luggage in his trunk. I hop in his car. Okay, it's a small airport. So picture the parking lot's right outside. Hop in his car. I grab my audio equipment. I have the script ready to go on my computer. We did three read-throughs, and I got the narration in the airport parking lot for the film. And it was so important. Again, that's it's great. Just preparation. You know, like luck is when preparation meets opportunity. I said, hey, can you please meet me at, like, let's say 1:30 p.m. in the parking lot? I'll be there. He said, yes, no problem. But if I didn't have the script ready to go, my audio equipment was buried in some bag. It never would have happened. I actually recorded, like, quite a few different variations of the narration because I didn't know what version I wanted to use. But again, because the accents are so specific to the Cayman Islands and different regions of the Cayman Islands, I had to get people reading it with a Caymanian accent, with a Bracker accent. It can't be a British accent. It can't be an American accent, and it has to be specific. So there's little details like that sprinkled in the film that really make it, you know, true, authentic to detail. I think really polish up the film to what it became.
Was it a poem at the beginning and the end, or did you just write that?
Yeah, so it's written like a poem. I wanted it to be sort of like a reflection on the person I did the narration with, James Ryan, is also in 70s or 80s now. And it really is like an ode to like the changes in the Cayman Islands, but that we really do owe it to the island and where we grew up and our heritage and culture to really save and preserve what the island was and what it is today.
You definitely have a beautiful touch for filmmaking, and I enjoyed it. Tell me what's happening with it. You submitted it to film festivals. How's it going?
Yeah, so we submitted to, I believe, 19 festivals altogether. We just finished the film at the beginning of January, and we're just waiting to hear back from our festivals to see where we get in and where we don't. So,
all right.
Very exciting. Yeah, having a good festival run with it this year, hopefully.
Good. Well, best of luck to you with that. Now, I want to shift gears. This exciting thing I've been talking about is called Filmmaker Friday that you started here in Chicago. It's all a buzz about what's happening. Tell me what this is.
So Filmmaker Friday is this event series that I co-founded with my friend Parker Foster. He started doing Filmmaker Friday events in New York City in tandem with our event series in Chicago. I wanted to create an event that I would want to attend myself and an event that I wish I had when I was starting out. I think finding a high quality event where there's great networking and different people always to network with and there's good attendance is really hard. It's pretty rare. And our first event had like 50 people and our fourth event was over 200. And at this point last year, within a year, we had 14 different events. We hosted over 1,700 unique attendees, all for free. And I would say we're probably unofficially the largest attendance consistent film community event in the city of Chicago.
That's awesome. Congratulations for that. Talk to me about what the vision is. What's its purpose? And how often do you meet and where do you meet?
Yeah, so we meet once to twice per month, depending on my schedule and the venue availabilities. We host a variety of different events. We either do only mixers that are just networking, open floor networking, or we do structured events where we start with networking. We have a 1-hour panel discussion, and then we wrap it up with some more networking after the event. Those have been really successful because you can network and come and learn something and then have something to talk about with people who also come to the events. And really the purpose of this event is to better connect the film community. I think, like I started at the beginning, I think filmmaking is a very lonely process at times. I think it seems very glamorous from the outside, but there's a lot of paperwork and busy work on the back end that can make it very lonely. And I think going out to network with your peers and connect with new people is really important, especially when you're in the thick of it. You're super busy. I think you have to keep planting those seeds and meeting new people because you never know when those are going to blossom and flourish into new opportunities in the future. So creating this consistent place for filmmakers to connect, I think, has been incredibly valuable for not just myself. Like I love attending the events too, but people that have attended ever since we started. As for venues, it's always at a different venue. We go to breweries, we go to film studios, We hosted 4 events at the Chicago Cultural Center last year, which is amazing. That was all in collaboration with the Chicago Film Commission. And really it just depends. We hosted a variety of different venues. It's never the same venue twice in a row.
Have not been yet, but I really do look forward to getting there. Now, who have you invited? Who has spoken? Tell me about that.
So we've hosted a variety of different topics for our panel discussions. We've covered documentary filmmakers, DPs and producers and directors. We've had editors who have edited Netflix murder mystery series, for Netflix and HBO. We've had advertising creative professionals like creative directors and executive creative directors from big agencies in Chicago. As you guys know, Chicago is a big advertising city. And we've had actors come. We've had actors from Chicago Med, Chicago PD. Leroy Hawkins was gracious enough to swing by last year for an amazing panel. That was one of our funniest we did. And we've also done film showcases where people submit work and we do screenings and share each other's work in a more casual setting than like a big official festival. So big variety. You can always learn something new. And I think even if the topics don't directly pertain to you, let's say you're an editor, but you're coming to a panel with, you know, producers and directors, I think learning about different aspects of production, no matter where you are in the industry and where you are in your career, I think is super important. I specifically built these events to be for students and industry professionals alike. So please join us at the next one.
Yeah, I absolutely will be there. All right, we have a segment that is everyone's favorite called DocuView Deja Vu, where we talk about documentaries that people like to recommend. Are you prepared to share with us a documentary?
Let me see. There's one that's unreleased that my friend is doing their festival run with. It's called Plant Life. Josh Isenberg is the director of it. He directed a film that I will recommend that is publicly out called Game Hawker. It was sponsored by Patagonia, which is a beautiful 25-minute film publicly available on YouTube. I'll recommend Game Hawker. Beautiful. Also a conservation film. It's about also about birds, ironically. Beautiful film. You guys should check it out on YouTube.
Super. Yeah. Well, I have one to recommend this week. It's very interesting. And the reason I'm recommending it is because it solved an interesting problem that was unique. I had never thought, would not have thought about how to solve a problem this way. So it's on Netflix and it's called The Billionaire, The Butler and The Boyfriend. Have you heard about this?
I have not. No.
Okay, it's from 2023. It is the log line is, how did a feud between the world's richest woman and her daughter develop into a major scandal? This documentary series takes an in-depth look at the whole story. So the directors are Maxime Bonnet and Baptiste Etchengary. And this is about Madame Betancourt, Liliane Betancourt, and her daughter. And this is the story. She's was the richest woman in the world. And she was the wife. Well, I guess she was the owner. Her father was the owner of L'Oreal. You know, she just had, so much money. She didn't know what to do with it. And she began being taken advantage of. And so this is the story of what happens. And the woman that is the bookkeeper begins to inform the daughter that her mother is being taken advantage of by the boyfriend, who really isn't a boyfriend because he's gay, but he is her friend. And so the daughter begins to find these things out and she wants to protect her mother. And then all the staff, which is like, it really is like Downton Abbey. This woman has this, you know, all these staff and everybody's talking against everybody else. And the butler begins to be afraid of his job. And so he starts secretly recording the conversations between Lillian Betancourt and the person who is managing her finances, and all sorts of mayhem and hell breaks loose. And the problem that the film, it's not a film, it's actually a 3-part series. But the problem that they solve is that, of course, they have no video. They have no video of anything. All they have is audio. So what are they going to do? So they have audio and they have real photos that they can get a hold of all of these people. And so what are you going to do on video? So they solve it because it would be terrible if you're doing reenactments with people that don't look like them. You know, people really hate reenactments for the most part anyway. So what they did was they did this top-down blurred security cam video footage that looked down on each room where like the videotaping was happening. And so you could see down into the conversations and what was happening in the house. And they were dressed like they would be dressed, and they looked generally like the people would look. So it brought you into the story visually. And I thought it was pretty fascinating. Now, it did kind of get a little repetitive because there weren't a lot of rooms that the tapes were taped in. And so they didn't have a lot of options for what to film. But it kept me interested enough to watch for three shows. But it was a fascinating story. The billionaire, the butler, and the boyfriend. Interesting filmmaking ideas. This has been absolutely fabulous, as always, talking with you. I really appreciate your insight, your background, your new way of thinking about filmmaking and connecting filmmakers and your ways of using AI. And you just bring a lot to our industry. And I'm super excited to see where your career goes and how you help kind of bring our industry along with you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we'd love to have you back for your next one.
Maybe next year.
All right, everybody, please take a moment to follow us, leave us a review. It's really a great way to support us. Thank you so much for listening to Documentary First, where we believe everybody has a story to tell, and you can be the one to tell it. Bye, everybody.